I think there definitely is value in penetration tests because it's good to understand what tactics and techniques attackers are using. So we had a really good company in my last company that we used, and it was more of purple teaming, actually. They showed us how they did curb roasting, how they ran Sharphound to feed into Bloodhound. And I think one of your questions was, have you ever had pen testers not be successful? Well, we were really close. But then he found a Windows 2008 server that didn't have EDR, was jacked up. He ran an SMB, I think it was like Eternal Blue, and then had a local admin password that was the same on all computers. And he went from, on the last day, almost not getting in to domain admin.
Wow.
So it was a wild ride. But that's all it takes. You know, that's why asset inventory is so important. Because there was just one server that we didn't get through to, and he found it and used SMB, like pass the hash, and all these tools that he told us about. And then we used after that pen test to make sure it didn't happen again.
I'm Steve Stormbreaker, and this is Ephemeral Security. Would you please state your name and what you do?
I'm Ryan Fried. I'm a security engineer at Brooks Running.
And you're also a teacher too, right?
Yep. Yeah. So I teach adjunct for a cybersecurity program back in Massachusetts at Mass Bay Community College.
Awesome. And what made you want to start teaching?
So when I was in college, I taught like a first year experience course. Basically, I was a senior and taught freshmen how to get around campus. And I really liked it. I liked being able to talk to them and teach them and help them out. So when I was at Aetna, I started pursuing my master's degree to potentially teach adjunct. And then I moved to Boston, saw an opportunity to teach at a local community college who was just starting their cybersecurity program, and taught full-time for 2 years. I've been teaching adjunct for 5 years after that.
Nice. So you taught, you got your master's, and then you just went straight into teaching, but you also were working full-time?
So I was teaching full-time for 2 years at the community college while doing some consulting work on the side for like compliance stuff and mapping the SIG. And then after those 2 years, I went back into industry and continued to teach adjunct for a different community college, which I've been doing for the last 5 years.
So for those of us that aren't in the academic realm, what does adjunct mean?
Sure. Yeah. So it's teaching part-time. So it's usually teaching 1 to 2 classes per semester.
Okay. And what type of stuff are you teaching?
So we're primarily a Cisco networking academy. So I'll teach CCNA 1, CCNA 2, switching, routing, wireless essentials, CCNA security, and then classes around securing access and things like Linux, Active Directory, and those kind of technologies.
So I remember when I was in school, my professor told me, he's like, look, he's like, you're learning about all this cool stuff, but when you get in the real world, you're going to find really archaic systems, and it's not going to be like all this sweet stuff. It's going to be like, you're just going to have to kind of deal with it. Like, do you kind of, what do you do to ready your students, I guess, for the difference between the academic world and then the real world, where like Windows 2000 still exists?
Yeah, I wish someone warned me about that. I try to warn my students as much as possible. Remember at Aetna, we still had mainframes and COBOL and stuff like that. But you know, I typically talk about how certain companies might have Windows 2003, 2008 now, why they might have it, and then certain things that you can do like segmentation or isolating it and locking it down a bunch. But one thing I like to do in class, and it seems like my students like a lot, is talk about real world stories. So it's one thing to talk about like BGP or port security or 802.1x, but it's another thing to talk about like when Facebook went off the internet in the last year and why that might have happened and how that works from a high level. That way they understand like what the potential implications are. So I usually try to bring up 1 or 2 security articles per week and how it relates to our class.
Nice. I think I was... at my last company, there was someone who was, he was in some sort of class, and he's like, yeah, I have to bring in a news article like every week and like write something on it. It's really just cybersecurity. I think it might have been mine too. It was pretty cool. there's all kinds of interesting stuff going on. So you go over the real world scenarios with, like, you know, Facebook going offline. But what about, like, attacks on protocols? Do you ever go over anything like that? I think when there was that dude that, like, broke DNS.
Yeah. So I talk about, like, watering hole type attacks, because you think about different companies being attacked. But I think years ago, there was the DNS provider on the East Coast that was taken down and showed the implications for a lot of different social media sites.
Is that Dyn?
Dyn, yeah. So talking about the importance of DNS, we talk about tunneling or DNS exfil, things like that. It's understanding that just because it goes over port 53 doesn't mean it's actually DNS. So the importance of, like, layer 7 firewalls versus traditional layer 4 firewalls.
Nice. So do you have, like, a best day or worst day teaching?
Yes, for sure. Best day teaching is when you get a ton of participation from students. They tell stories. You know, it's not just you talking to them for an hour. My worst day on almost every year is when we have review for our final exam, which is hands-on for different networking type things for routers and switches. And I say, all right, class, we're just going to do something basic. Can we give this interface an IP address and a router? And I get total silence as if I taught nothing over the last 16 weeks.
Wow.
And eventually someone will pitch in when you keep them going. But sometimes that's tough. But, you know, sometimes I'll get people that will participate that I didn't expect to. And maybe they've been quiet the whole semester, but they've been listening and they'll chime in during that dead silence. So it's good and bad.
Nice. In terms of, like, so I don't know, I've noticed, I guess, over the past, like, maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years, some of the terminology has kind of changed. So instead of, like, blacklist and whitelist, it's like allow list and deny list and stuff like that. And I think that's, you know, that I'm fine with it. I think it's good. But have you kind of, as I kind of changed in terms of, like, your teaching as well, have you noticed certain terms and stuff that are kind of being tweaked now?
I do my best. I mean, the content's not updated too often, maybe every couple of years. I do appreciate where, like, for instance, Cisco is starting to talk more about OSPF, where for the last 5 years I taught RIP.
Really?
Yeah, I couldn't. It's easy. It's easy to configure, but I've never run into it in a network since I've been working in InfoSec. So they finally started including, like, wireless security, WPA2, and Radius, and then including common protocols like OSPF for dynamic routing. So they do a pretty good job updating every once in a while. They're starting to go more into, like, APIs, be able to configure network devices. So they catch up every few years.
Interesting. The Radius stuff reminded me of, like, so beginning of COVID, I was at a company and they had, you know, 7,000, 8,000 more people needing to get on the VPN, right? In, like, one day.
Yeah.
And the Radius servers, we didn't have enough Radius servers, right? And so they were load balanced, but when one was down, it's like a cascading effect, right? And so instead of having 2,000 between each Radius server, you know, have, like, 4,000 on the other two Radius servers, right? And so then they all start going down. And then you just end up with weird stuff where, like, all right, I fixed the Radius servers, but it's still not working. It's like, oh, well, I hit my API rate limit for Okta, right? And it's just, like, one thing after another. And it's like, oh, it all have logging in place, right? So then, like, to even figure that out, you don't have logging. It's just, like, I don't know. It's always, like, what is never, like, a simple solution. Or, I mean, sometimes it is, but I don't know. Those types of weird things, it's so hard to teach students to do. But it's really about, I guess, curiosity and teaching them to, like, really want to figure it out.
Yeah, and that's my biggest thing is I'm not the content expert really on anything, but if I can pique their curiosity about things and now they're starting to do, like, try Hack Me or Hack the Box or different CTFs. That's where I feel like I've been successful. I feel like some of the other things I've done recently to pique their interest. So, you know, talk about ransomware and how RDP is open to the world. And they're like, no way. Like, no one would ever do that. So then I go on Shodan and find, like, 2,000 servers that open RDP and can actually show the RDP login screen or show, like, open IP cameras. So another funny, like, eye-opening thing recently was, you know, classic password complexity of having 8 characters, a number, and a special character. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to do some guessing here. So they say that's, you know, that's complex. So I'm looking at all of you and I think, let me guess, your password starts with a capital letter and it ends with one exclamation point. And they're like, how did you know that? I'm like, it's not that hard. Like, it's not that complex. I would rather you have a 15 character password with no complexity using different dictionary words or a phrase than something that I know people are lazy, right? They're going to have exactly 8 characters. They're going to capitalize their first letter and they're going to do one exclamation point, almost guaranteed. And they're like, I need to change my passwords. So real life stuff like that, talking about why that's not necessarily actually a best practice. And then I always teach them, I want them to be able to answer tech questions at home. So my parents are not very tech savvy. So they'll ask, I want a new computer. What kind should I get? And I teach them what kind of questions they can ask. Or my internet's not great. What do I do? I teach them to use like Insider or use Powerline networking, basically to be able to answer those questions, to be that IT person. Because I find that really helpful in developing those kind of troubleshooting skills.
Yeah, definitely. A lot about being in security is kind of knowing how to do everyone else's job in IT, right? And then it's like, how do I secure it?
Yeah.
So speaking of, I guess, true positive security incidents, right? So we talked about maybe some stuff that happens on the general internet, but in terms of stuff that maybe you were involved in, can you talk a little bit about any true positive security incidents?
Sure. Yeah. So at my last company, we had a user report to us that his mouse was being taken over and it was looking to change like Windows firewall settings. So it was a really good experience to be able to dump the RAM of the computer, use stuff like cyber triage or volatility, look at the about time frames, what programs was he going to, what websites was he going to. And we eventually found out, because we had his computer re-imaged, but it happened to him again. And long story short, after narrowing down the time frame and such, we found it was a YouTube page that he was going to around that time frame, which had a malicious advertisement that had a Java or Flash exploit that took control of his computer. So we made sure we blocked that domain across the enterprise, made sure no one else went to that, educated the user. Really, there's not much you can do, unfortunately, because there's just a classic YouTube page, and yeah, documented the steps that we did it just in case it happened again. So luckily it was limited to only one user. It was someone higher up, so we had to give a lot of attention to it.
You can't be like, why are you on YouTube? It's like, okay, like you're allowed on YouTube.
Right. I can't block YouTube. So it was one of my first experiences with malvertising. I kind of went down the rabbit hole reading about it, how like there's no user interaction that's needed. Like, and then we looked into, so as a lesson learned, we looked into browser-based protections to make sure it stays isolated within the browser.
What, like Bromium or something like, I think it's like Symantec bought Fireglass.
Yeah, so we were looking at Bromium.
And so did you end up going with Bromium or just testing it or what?
So we didn't wind up purchasing it. We worked with our EDR vendor to see like what browser-based protections we can have in there. I don't think a lot of companies are thinking about like browser extensions, but browsers and identity is really the new endpoint. And if you're not controlling like browser extensions or making sure they're only downloading ones that are safe, like that leaves a huge security gap. But I feel like no one's really talking about that.
There is one company.
Is there?
So the guys that created Fireglass, they got acquired by Symantec. So Fireglass was, they used an Nginx reverse proxy. And it would render web pages as images. So there was nothing malicious that could execute on your endpoint. And they got acquired. And so now they have some of the founders of that. So a new company called Island. And it's an enterprise browser, Chromium-based enterprise browser. You control like everything in it. And it can do like DLP and all kinds of crazy stuff. So like hopefully there's going to be, you know, once the product comes out, it's going to be good. I think it's come out of stealth mode now. But yeah, I agree. It's so funny. We spent all this time SSL decrypting and then there's certificate pinning, right? Which sucks. And you can't decrypt it. And you have the EDR and you do everything possible. But then the browser is just kind of like free reign, right? So it's a real problem.
Yeah.
Ad blocking is always good if you can get people to do it. But yeah, we had something at one company I was at where one of our SQL servers, like production SQL servers, it went to this malicious website and it downloaded some malicious and executed it. And the DBA, he's like head DBA, that's database administrator. He swore all he did was he went to the start menu. He typed services.msc and hit enter. What happened was he typed services.ms. Then he hit enter, which triggered, because this was like the newer version of Windows, like Server 2008 or something, or 2012, it triggered a Bing search. And whoever owned services.ms was a nefarious person. And so as soon as that search triggered services.ms, some payload downloaded this on the production SQL server. It was pretty sneaky. It was a really weird find too. But just weird stuff like that, man, it happens.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that, like, one thing we're starting to look into is outbound filtering from servers, where, you know, we're trying to make it as hard as possible for, I mean, one, for servers to get infected, but two, for them to be able to call back to C2 domains. So if we can stop them earlier on and they couldn't go to services MS, which is something they probably never have gone to, maybe it's a domain that was created in the last 30 days, we can stop it there. It's hard.
Yeah, especially because C2s are doing callbacks now through CDNs, right? And if it's just calling an S3 bucket or something like that, right? You know, it's usually hard to find. But definitely the less frequently called ones, there's definitely analytics and stuff you can do on that for sure. So I know one of the topics we want to talk about today was purple teaming. What does purple teaming mean to you?
Sure. So purple teaming, I've been on some pretty small teams lately of 2 or 5 people where you take someone who has more red team experience, as well as someone or multiple people have blue team experience, and you're basically doing control validation. So our goal is to figure out who are the most relevant adversaries for us. What do we care about? So maybe something like ransomware or certain APTs that have been attacking our industry. And we want to do their tactics, techniques, and procedures against our controls to figure out, would we have stopped them? And if not, what detections can we put into place? It's a great thing to be able to tell your boss, like, we just read about Colonial Pipeline and we ran an emulation against that threat actor and we figured out we mostly would have stopped them, but we just wrote a detection where we missed. So it's really nice to be able to do that more often instead of waiting to do it once a year, you know, hiring a pen test company.
And so that's great. I guess one thing that kind of comes to mind with that is, do you ever find that when you're doing purple teaming that your controls aren't what you thought they were? Like you have all these assumptions like, oh, I'm running, you know, the latest fully patched operating system, my EDR vendor, I have it fully deployed, it's set to high, and you do the experiment and the command and control gets installed and you're just like, what the hell? Does that ever happen? You get surprised and stuff with it? Or?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, a classic example is, you know, we have a control that we have MFA everywhere. And, you know, we thought that was true. We used a tool called MFA Everywhere, and it basically impersonates, you know, a Windows device, a Mac device, looks for like OWA portals that, or uses EWS for legacy protocols that don't require 2FA. Because if you can bypass it that way, which is how it normally would have been done, then it's no good. But we found out that we didn't enforce 2FA for mobile devices. So most people with a little technical acumen can impersonate their user agent string to say Android. Now all of a sudden they bypass 2FA. So we use that to basically feed into our priorities for the quarter, and making sure that we remediated that. And, you know, classic, we were testing something, we didn't change it back. You know, it's not usually done on purpose, but that was something we didn't expect to see. And it proved the value of purple teaming right there.
Yeah, definitely. So do you ever do anything like curb roasting?
Yeah, for sure. That was one we did pretty recently. So that was something that I expected our EDR to catch, but we found out that our EDR chose not to log Kerberos ticket requests by default, which is something we wouldn't have checked because it is really noisy, which is fair. But we were able to dump SPNs and find ones that maybe weren't the highest encryption, and it went undetected. So that was another one that we found recently and didn't expect to. Where companies have done that in the past, it caught it pretty quickly, you know, seeing all the Kerberos ticket request in a short amount of time. So that's something where we put in a feature request with the EDR vendor. We're looking to enable that logging to have detections for it.
Yeah, that's super tricky. It's eye-opening, I guess, when your vendor doesn't do it, especially when a previous vendor did it. I've seen some of that. What about, I guess, I'm not sure what the term is, but basically where like a log source stops sending logs or the volume of logs or certain event codes are just no longer being sent. Do you ever set any alerts for that?
So we didn't have anything set for if we stopped seeing, like if we had a large volume of like successful or failed logins, then all of a sudden we don't see any. But another part of Purple Teaming feeds into our like workstation and server hardening, where as we run these commands, maybe we weren't logging according to best practice. So that would once again feed into our quarterly projects saying, you know, we weren't logging these things like unsuccessful logins. This is important. This is the attack that it didn't detect but should have. We need to enable this. So it gives us really good buy-in and validation for things that we're hoping to do. You know, it's one thing to say we need to turn this on. It's another thing to say one of the top ransomware actors like Conti or something uses this tactic. We didn't catch it. We need this for detection. So it feeds into almost everything we do.
Nice. Some of my favorite alerts are the domain admin group has been changed. Like send an alert every time on that, right? Do you have any favorite alerts that you like to have enabled?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. So we have ones where accounts are created that don't require pre-authorization. I personally like Kerberosting a lot. But one of my favorites, I think, is Who Am I? So I use Atomic Red Team a lot for Purple Teaming. And most computers don't run Who Am I? But almost every single tactic you run in Atomic Red Team has to run Who Am I? So that's been a pretty high fidelity one where if we see that run, it's either a developer or it's potential malware.
Nice. So you've used Atomic Red Team?
We do, yeah.
And is that just with Windows or Linux as well?
I run it in PowerShell.
Okay. So I've read up on some Atomic Red Team. I think I've only used the Linux stuff for it. So would you be able to talk about your experience with it?
Yeah, for sure. You know, it takes a little bit of a learning curve. It's open source, which is great. You have to figure out allow listing to actually get it to import the module because EDRs will usually complain. But once you're able to do that and you're able to import the module, pretty simple to use. You know, you figure out what atomic test you want to run. You can use a show details argument, look what it's actually going to do. And you can use that when you actually try to write your detections. You run the command, it runs in seconds, and then you use the cleanup argument and it cleans it up. And it only takes one time of forgetting that, stuff like that. So you learn that pretty quickly. But yeah, overall, it's really easy to use. I usually update the atomic tests maybe every couple weeks, but it's great. You know, we Purple Team on a $0 budget. It includes Excel worksheets, Atomic Red Team, some other open source tools, and we're getting much more value out of that than other tools that we could use. There is a place for paid things like Scythe. You know, if reporting is important to you and maybe you don't have the technical expertise to run Atomic Red Team, but you know, after a little bit of a learning curve, we've gotten pretty much everything we needed for it.
So it sounds like you have a repeatable framework that you run, is that right?
We do, yeah. So we'll have someone do their research of what adversary is relevant to us, figure out what the MITRE sub-techniques are, write them down, run the test, and then we have someone do the detection, you know, via like searches in our SIEM to find them and write any follow-ups we might have. So yeah, we try to have a cycle of every 2 to 4 weeks.
Nice. I wanted to switch gears to when you were a virtual CISO. How did you become a virtual CISO?
Sure. So 2 companies ago, we were a startup that, I mean, it was around for about 13 years, but I was the first and only security person. So I started off as a security engineer and then did more like policy work and basing our program off of like NIST-CSF and SysTop. It was 20 at the time. So I went from, you know, more of a practitioner to more CISO duties and presenting to executives, doing security awareness, those kind of things. So I wasn't one of those CISOs that, you know, are outsourced and come in and such, but I was basically a security engineer trying to figure out what direction you want to take our program in. And then eventually did more like things at the strategic level rather than the hands-on security work.
So you were in the nerdery being an engineer, and then you had to talk to executives. Was that a tough transition, or did you have experience talking with executives before that? Or
yeah, so when I was at Aetna and I worked for one of the subsidiaries, when I actually worked with you at B-Swift, and I had a really good mentor of learning like what executives care about, giving them the facts they need to know, not going too deep into the weeds, and basically learning how to tell a story of, here's our security program where we are now, this is where we want to go, and these are the steps that we need to take. So I definitely had a little bit of experience from a previous job, but you know, it always takes practice of being able to translate security risks of, we patched all of our CVSS 10s. They don't care. They don't know what that is. You know, we talk about reducing the risk of our high-risk servers and working towards 100%. So giving it to things that they actually care about.
Yeah, it can be really tricky because a lot of the jargon, they have no idea. They don't care.
Yeah. And I think it was one thing I was going to go into, where some of the best security advice, or advice in general that I've gotten, is, you know, no business, at least not like non-security businesses, they aren't in business to be secure, right? They're in business to make money. And you need to understand that. I think one thing I tell my students all the time is, you present the risk and the business ultimately makes the decision. So you can't just auto-update servers, right? You need to plan accordingly. And sometimes it's not worth the downtime, and that's a documented risk. So it's tough to come up with all these things, but ultimately you need to think about the business and them making money and understanding uptime and stuff like that. So that was some of the best advice I was ever given.
Yeah, that's really good advice. And I guess maybe to go off of that, you need to make sure whomever's accepting the risk is the right person that's actually authorized to accept the risk, right? It can't just be like some random dev manager, right? You know? So going back to, I guess, when you were at it, I noticed there was a lot of good stuff I picked up when I was there. And I was, so Aetna had acquired the company I was at B-Swift. We were an affiliate, and they had affiliate Thursdays. And we got to hang out on the daily security call. I'm guessing, were you on the daily security calls like every day?
Yep.
Because I was only on it Thursdays. And would you be able to just talk about some of those, the way they structured those meetings? It was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was awesome. And I think that goes into, you know, why I got into information security. I think, you know, with Jim Routh coming into Aetna, he really brought the program to a new level. And it was crazy to think, basically they were called threat and vulnerability assessment calls. They brought in representatives from everything like infrastructure, development, security. And they talked about certain metrics every time. And it was a really cool place to discuss, you know, trends, things that need to be taken care of, things like patching. Dave Crawford is one of the smartest security people I've ever met. He would talk about threats that he's seen either in the wild, in the dark web, or threats that Aetna was going against. And all in one call, he can talk about a threat and he can ask whoever the infrastructure person or development person or another security person that's relevant questions about that, and they can communicate with it on that call every day at 4 o'clock. So it was what I looked forward to almost every day, to be able to join those and hear some really smart security people talk about metrics that Jim cared about, as well as what threats they're seeing globally and how it might affect Aetna. You know, so they might say there's the Russia-Ukraine war and they might have found malware here. How could that possibly affect Aetna or any of the affiliates, and what can we do about it? So they were doing threat intel and research better than anyone I've seen. They were super proactive about it.
Yeah, it was super cool. It was like, we had 800 phishing emails today. We had 30 people click it. They were the first, you know, patient zero. We re-imaged those laptops, and it was just like clockwork. And it was a it was really cool. And then on Thursday is the day I got called to the meeting. If we had any security exceptions that were coming up, we would get grilled on why that exception, like why we need an extension for that exception and things like that. Because, you know, if you had a control break, and a control break is you are violating a control. So let's say you had a DNS record that was pointing to an internal IP address, right? That's not like the biggest deal, but it's still a control violation. You shouldn't have internal IP addresses publicly available on DNS records. So you would get grilled on that, things like that. So it's kind of interesting. So what about lessons you've learned the hard way? Can you tell me about some of those?
Yeah, there's two that come to mind. So when I was at that affiliate of Aetna, I was a network engineer learning how to work with like ASAs and ACLs on routers. So we were doing a change. We were multi-tenant and the firewall we had didn't have like the different like contacts. So it was all, you know, the same edge firewall. And we were doing a change. I was creating an ACL on the firewall and I fat fingered an ACL. So I created a new ACL, put it on an interface, which has a default deny. So luckily it was 11 PM. I think it was like mountain time and nobody can get to this external website. So luckily I had a good network engineer who was on the call as well, looked at the command history, figured it out pretty quickly, but they were forgiving. We had some more like change control and reviewing changes. You taught me how to like write stuff out beforehand and learn how to back things out. So that was a good experience and a good environment for people to, you know, to learn from my mistake. And then another one somewhat recently is, so we have security automation. One of our workflows was to search and delete messages that were known phishing messages. So something you might see a lot, I'm sure, is good vendors having their email hacked that sends phishing messages, which is hard because you can't just block that sender because they have legitimate email. So we had that happen. We searched, you know, put in the search query and I ended, it was like a that's with an apostrophe, but that's where the subject query ended. So it was any email sent from that good sender that starts with that and then rejects basically the rest of it, which deleted 2,000 emails from that vendor of all time. So worked with infrastructure, got those emails back in the mailbox and put good guardrails around only deleting emails from that day, no matter when it's done. And then if there's any time where more than 100 people were affected, send a, are you sure message, you know? So after that, I've definitely put more guardrails around automation for those kind of use cases.
Yeah, those are definitely tricky. What I've noticed too with some of the, when I was doing phishing triage, the bad guys know, like if you're using, let's say, for example, Microsoft, right? Office 365, they know the limitations of the query language, I guess, called KQL.
KQL, yeah.
And one problem we had is the bad guys would make their emails dynamic and they would be just dynamic enough to where you could not do a search that was effective to actually grab them all. And so you had to send them having to go through and manually delete them in some cases, or you have to get some really, really creative regexes or hope that they did something that was kind of a tell.
Yeah, I've seen some pretty creative stuff from phishing emails. Like, you know, usually the limitation is the email security tool only detonate that first link, but a lot of the times it leads you to a link, which then clicks on another link, which is where the malware actually is, or like file size detonation where it can detonate files over a certain size, and then you can choose to fail open or fail closed. So, you know, for the commodity phishing, like email security is pretty good, but I've seen some pretty creative things to get around default security controls.
Yeah, there's some really weird stuff too, where the bad guys will, based on your external IP address, they'll return different pages or based on your browser user agent or, you know, they can rotate it too. And like you said, with the 302 redirects, you could have just a chain of them, right? And they can change them whenever they feel like it. So it can be a real nightmare. And just because you have like one, everything's okay, you know, lookup, doesn't mean you can't turn malicious later. So that's certainly a problem. So I know we talked about before this show, attack surface management and also third-party assessments, I guess. So like security scorecard, for example, I think there's a few other vendors in that space. Do you have experience with those tools?
Yeah. So BitSight's another vendor in that space. I totally understand the use case for it. And if you're trying to assess third-party vendors, or if you're a parent company and trying to assess, you know, your subsidiary security, basically, from our experience, it'll do basic things like look for TLS ciphers or headers, you know, within websites that should be turned on.
What about the body, the HTTP body?
I'm trying to think. I don't know that it did like great fuzzing or like application scanning, not the ones I've had experience with.
I've only found one vendor that does the body.
So then essentially it'll give you a letter grade at the end of it. It might look at email gateways, it might look at like DMARC records, DKIM, stuff like that. And it's tough because your executives always want to score an A, right? You never want to have a C or a B or something like that. And does it actually reduce risk of changing your TLS cipher from TLS minimum of like 1.0 to 1.1 or 1.2? I don't know. I don't think it changes it that much, but it's a really good opportunity to win credit with your management. You know, like you can dread it and say like, oh, do I really need to change that? But if I can make my executive management look good and get an A, that's a win in my books. And then we might use that credit in another time. So I hope it's one of those companies I think about, like startups and, you know, what companies we could start. It's one of those things where there's nothing better out there that I know of. But I wish there was, to actually assess a company's external presence and how secure they are. Looking for things like open buckets or blobs or different things you can look for and like their public cloud presence. So yeah, if someone finds a vendor, I'm all ears, but I haven't found one yet.
I recently did a number of vendor evaluations for attack service management. And what I found was that almost no vendors scan over 3,000 ports. There's a certain number of ports that they'll scan. Normally, it's in the thousands range. And some vendors will only scan twice a week. Other vendors scan once a day. And you can do weird situations where you get alerts for IP addresses that you no longer own because your cloud's so ephemeral. And it just ends up being a lot of noise, right? Or you scan your external footprint yourself on all the ports, and you find out that you have some weird shit open, right? That the tool didn't catch at all. So that was definitely a problem for me. One tool in particular, they used to have a product that was very full featured because they were able to look at flow data from major internet exchange points to determine what traffic was yours, but they lost that ability. So now their tool's not as great. That was a real sweet feature. Now they have that patented and everything, but they just lost the licenses with the interchange points. But yeah, I agree. A proper external footprint tool would be really great. Ivor is a tool. It's open source, IVRE. It does multi-threaded nmap scanning, and then it lets you visualize your results. It's pretty cool. It takes a lot of work to get set up, but that's what I've used to scan external footprints. Like very large external footprints, if you can export, let's say for AWS, you export all of your network adapters and the external IP address for all your network adapters hooked up to RDS, EC2, load balancers everywhere. And you export all your DNS records from all your authoritative DNS servers, and then you scan all of those at every port. And if you could do that every day, you pat yourself on the back.
Yeah, I think Palo Alto has a tool, I haven't used it yet, called Expanse, which is supposed to help find your external footprint. But we actually recently had an issue where we had a company scan our external presence. They found one of our DNS records, which had a server that had RDP open to the world, which was news to us. So we dropped everything and, you know, we used DNS dumpster and looked at all of our DNS records, found that one. Couldn't find that server in our public cloud, and eventually figured out that that server was decommissioned, but we never decommissioned the DNS record. So that IP address was still associated on like VirusTotal or URL scan or whatever to our IP address. So it looked like we had that risk. So we cleaned up that DNS record to rid us of that issue. And then we've made a point to dump all of our DNS records, put that into a vulnerability scanner just to be proactive about that. But yeah, finding your external presence is hard. You know, people talk about public cloud and it's more secure, but sometimes you put people who are in like business positions in charge of creating cloud services and a more discretionary access model. And that's hard.
The number one enemy of the cloud is a full stack developer. So I guess talking about the cloud security, do you have experience with Cloud Security Posture Management, CSPM?
I do. So we've used Prisma Cloud. We're looking at some other vendors now. You know, essentially, you create API connections to your different clouds. If you're in one cloud, a lot of that can be done natively, but we're multi-cloud. And it will basically look at what are the biggest risks. So obviously, you know, open anything like open ACL, security groups, open RDP or different ports of the world. So some common hygiene. There are ones that will ingest flow logs and could do anomaly detection there. There are ones that can map it to different compliance frameworks. So I find one that would be good for me, which we haven't really found yet, is doing anomaly detection, you know, looking at what cloud threats are out there and then reporting on those, and ones that are pretty high fidelity, because we've had ones that'll flap and say, RDP is open. No, it's not. RDP is open. No, it's not. different stuff like that. So I haven't found one that I absolutely love, but I do find the need for it because the cloud is just an extension of your data center. You need to apply controls just like you would in your data center.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So I do have experience with Prisma Cloud. It takes a very long time to tune. But I mean, like when you see like the RDP's open, no, it's not. A lot of times it'll be some developer put in a rule that permits traffic from quad zero, like in every port, right? So all of your alerts go off. But really, there's no external IP address assigned to that, which means the risk is zero, right? In terms of being attacked externally. So stuff like that, it drives you mad as an incident responder. And you just want to tell your developers to like stop doing that. They're like, well, technically they're right. There's not really a threat. It just makes your stuff go off. So then you have to figure out how to like code around it and stuff. And, you know, it's a battle you might build eventually win, but it might take some time. So it's almost easier to just write more specialized rules and stuff and then try to get the workflow changed and basically have a cleanup phase. And then everything going forward doesn't have those rules. It can be frustrating.
Yeah, I've had, when I use Prisma Cloud, we didn't subscribe for like the Microsoft security subscription for a lot of the different tools. So, you know, we had half of our controls that it said we didn't use were paid subscription items, which is something you're not used to like on-prem. So it's something that helped justify us get that security subscription. But yeah, it definitely needed a lot more tuning.
Are you talking about MCAS?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's, what is that for? What does that stand for again?
Microsoft's Cloud Access Security, maybe. I don't know. They recently changed the security like subscription level to be paid for.
Yeah. I remember using, I don't think I ever got one good alert from MCAS. they would tell you that there's impossible travel and you'd go look and it wasn't impossible travel or something like that. But I think we used it in forensic situations when we wanted to figure out who's touched what in the Microsoft Cloud arena, like who's opened what file, what email was open, what time they authenticated, where they authenticated from. So if you were doing a forensic investigation, it was kind of handy to have that kind of information. So I guess I could see its utility, especially having it all together coming into your CSPM. What I did like about, in particular, Palo Alto's CSPM, instead of talking smack about them the whole time, they do have some good features. They ingest NetFlow, which a lot of CSPM tools do not ingest NetFlow. And you can write some very complex queries against the NetFlow, and you can visualize it too. So if you have a server with port 22 open, you can visualize all the bad actors coming to that particular server. And it'll give you like threat reputation on them. And it's super cool. So I know I personally wrote a lot of custom rules against the NetFlow. And I thought that was cool.
Yeah. One thing I've been seeing in Sims now, which has been nice. So being able to write correlation queries against like CloudTrail data. So I didn't really see that before, but they can look for things like the golden ticket that was written for the solar flare.
Oh, yes. Solar winds. There's golden sample. And there's golden ticket and then there's golden sample. Golden sample is the bad one. I mean, they're both bad, but golden sample is way worse.
Right. Yeah, but abusing it. Yeah, so it's been really nice to be able to see Sims to be able to write in correlation and threat hunting rules against potential malicious cloud events, like CloudTrail events or events in Azure. which is something that's new, because once again, that you can't just look at on-prem for those types of threats and anomaly detection. You need to do that for cloud as well.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I think that's some of the stuff that I've seen, like, I don't know, more interesting stuff is CrowdStrike. They acquired, I think it was it Humio? So they acquired Humio, and then there was the, I forget if they were the identity management one, but they had the Active Directory protection. And they were going to integrate that with their main CrowdStrike Falcon. And it was super slick, because when I looked at some other tools, specifically for Active Directory protection, the tool CrowdStrike bought was leaps and bounds beyond what the other companies were doing in terms of Silver Ticket, Golden SAML, Kerberosing, all that. And even their demo was good. We could probably talk all day about bad product demos, but yeah, they had their stuff together.
Yeah, one product that I thought was really cool. So the previous company, we used Varonis, which is great for compliance and figuring out where all your data is and classification. They have really cool security add-ons. They have some really high fidelity alerts for things like ransomware, Kerberosing, that kind of stuff. And they have, you know, a really great dashboard for looking at, once again, like devices that have SPNs that also have admin privileges, or devices that don't require pre-authorization, which can be used to log in without a password. Different like AD type things that were configured once, like for testing, or weren't really thought through. And then they have free IR services and purple teaming on top of that. So that was a pretty cool tool to use for Active Directory, and then be able to test it and validate it and look what attackers might actually use.
That's interesting. Did they integrate Bloodhound, or have you used Bloodhound?
I've used Bloodhound. They didn't integrate it, but they've had like tests that you can run to alert on similar type activity. So yeah, that's a really cool way to, you know, figure out how many steps to get to domain admin. We've used that in purple teaming before.
Yeah, for our listeners that don't know what Bloodhound is, it's a pretty scary tool. But yeah, it is like, how many steps am I which paths can I take to get domain admin? And there's so many paths, and it's super scary, man, running Bloodhound.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we talked about purple teaming and all these things. I think there definitely is value in penetration tests, because it's good to understand what tactics and techniques attackers are using. So we had a really good company in my last company that we used, and it was more of purple teaming, actually. They showed us how they did Kerberosing, how they ran SharpHound to feed into Bloodhound. And I think one of your questions was, have you ever had pen testers not be successful? Well, we were really close. But then he found a Windows 2008 server that didn't have EDR, was jacked up. He ran an SMB, I think it was like a Eternal Blue, and then had a local admin password that was the same on all computers. And he went from, on the last day, almost not getting in to domain admin.
Wow.
So it was a wild ride. But that's all it takes. You know, that's why asset inventory is so important. Because there was just one server that we didn't get through to, and he found it. And used SMB, like pass the hash, and all these tools that he told us about. And then we used after that pen test to make sure it didn't happen again.
Was it 2008 R1?
Maybe. I don't know. The other one he used is it was a secrets dump. So we learned about how he had passwords in clear text, one of them being an admin password because of a legacy protocol. I think it was Wdigest. And we had no idea, you know, and that pen test uncovered it, and we fixed it and then validated it, and we were in a better spot. Something that we wouldn't have come up with during purple teaming. So it was helpful.
Yeah, definitely. And that really kind of brings up a good point in terms of validating. So that validating what you think your security is doing. So like, I'll come into companies and they'll be like, oh yeah, we have antivirus. It's like, okay, when's the last time you checked that all of your endpoints actually have your antivirus product? Like, oh, we don't. It's like, all right, well, let's check it out. And you'll find out that 20% of your machines don't actually have the product installed, right? So being able to do that at a certain cadence is super important to make sure all your controls are in place. And if there's a way to automate checking that every hour or something, even better, right?
Yeah. And that's something we struggle with, like many other companies, is asset inventory. So you know, you can have all the tools in the world, but if they're not everywhere, that presents a big risk. So I've seen vendors in the space like AppNovi or Axonius that are doing really cool things where it'll create API connections to your different security products or whatever software products you use. And it can cross-check the inventories for each of those products. You can say, I saw this server in VMware and CrowdStrike, but I didn't see the Qualys agent on there. So it helps avoid that manual process of like looking at spreadsheets and comparing numbers and figuring out what you have and where. It's a challenge, you know?
Yeah, it's actually, I've been beating the configuration management database, the CMDB drum, for years. And it's so hard to get one in place and have it set up properly. And it always needs lots of love. I've definitely seen a lot of bad CMDB implementations, but I'd rather have a bad CMDB than no CMDB personally. I mean, you're still frustrated every time you use the bad one, but it's better than nothing for sure. But I guess maybe kind of going from there to, if you think about cloud environments, like they have Kubernetes, Fargate, ECS containers, and they're kind of ephemeral. In terms of like a CMDB, you know, you have to have an API connection, right? And it has to be updated like pretty much automatically, right? You need to get like an API hook or something. Do you have any experience protecting those type of workloads?
Yeah, so I don't have experience necessarily with keeping track of them, like asset inventory, but we've definitely started to look into like Fargate and Kubernetes and Docker and all that good stuff. And that's one of the reasons I love security is, you know, a couple of years ago, that technology was like kind of early on. And obviously, I never went to school on any of that. You need to learn it pretty quickly and figure out how do you secure it. So we've been doing things like Checkoff is an open source tool that, you know, before things are built, it'll check for like basic hygiene. You know, you don't allow S3 like on all resources or be able to do stuff on all resources and all actions or quad zero access out from the internet. So there are basic checks like that that we can put into the developer's hands and guardrails basically. But then you also want to make sure those are scanned for vulnerabilities because they might use a lot of different open source packages. So it's definitely a challenge. Like we try to make the developers security champions, put the tools in their hands, put guardrails around it, because you know no one has time to be able to babysit those kind of workloads. So we've been with them during the development process, making sure we can do it secure from the beginning. That way it's something that we only have to respond to alerts.
And then something like Log4j hits.
Yeah. And I am so grateful to have a tool that can do like I forget the exact term, but basically an inventory of all your different packages. If we didn't have that, we would still be trying to track down Log4j. But luckily we had a software composition analysis to figure out where everything is. That was fun.
Yeah, no, it's super tricky, but it's also like what downstream could be using it, because you could be using some other software. It's using Log4j, you know, that's just software you purchased or something like that, or something open source, like even Elasticsearch and stuff, you know, have Log4j. So at that point, I don't know, I need to identify my external footprint, right? Everything I said earlier, like all your external IPs, all of your authoritative DNS, and you got to scan all of it for Log4j. It's like the only way to really be sure, right?
Yeah. And the fun part is we worked with a vendor that we host some of their stuff on premise, and they said they didn't have Log4j. We wrote a threat hunting query to look for the specific package to see if it's being executed anywhere in our environment. And it was. They're like, oh, good point. We'll investigate. So it's like that trust but verify, and being able to write queries to look for specific packages. And then understanding enough of, well, this package, like I think 1.something, like wasn't affected. So it, you know, we had to get spun up on it pretty quickly. And then yeah, trust but verify are important applications.
That's actually one of my favorite things in security is trust but verify. I mean, can you think of some situations where that really came in handy?
Yeah, so the MFA, like I talked about before, where assuming we had MFA everywhere, saying that we had SMB v1 disabled everywhere in the environment, and then running an Nmap script that looks for SMB exploits for different things and finding out some servers were missed. So we've found a good amount of stuff through purple teaming that they said they changed or closed things, but we found it wasn't actually true. We're finding default creds for appliances. That's always fun, especially if they have an external presence. Like, you can go on and on.
Yeah, it's true. And it's tricky to get, I mean, depending on, you know, what level you're at in your company, if you're just a regular engineer and those, that type of stuff might not be on the, your manager's critical path. They may have certain projects and stuff they want to do. So that's just stuff you have to kind of do in your free time. Or if you can convince your manager, like, hey, like, you know, this sprint or whatever, we should really be verifying that we've actually deployed our controls properly, or those kinds of things. It's really important to do. And then, you know, what I like to do is if I have free time, I'll just kind of poke around. And once you start finding weird stuff that's configured wrong, then you can kind of raise the alarm and then you suddenly have a project, right? And you get to check out what you wanted to check out in the first place.
Yeah. Threat hunting has been a lot of fun for me. Like recently I was looking for commands with clear text creds, like in the, for the password argument. We found something that was using it. So we chased it down and it was a big risk for us. And it's something that wasn't alerted on anywhere else. And I think I thought of that through like some article that we read of that's what malware looks for. So you know, that's the fun part. Be able to look for stuff proactively in your spare time and then hopefully be able to take action on it.
Yeah, definitely. So do you have any advice that you would give to people that want to get into information security?
I do. I would definitely recommend, one, apply. There's no harm in applying. It might, hopefully doesn't, but it might say like CISSP in 5 years for an entry level job. But if I were to hire somebody, looking for someone who has like networking background, some basic IT skills, but I usually look for like the home lab kind of stuff. Like, what are you doing in your spare time? Even if you're not in security, are you going towards Security Plus? Are you doing TryHackMe? Do you have a Raspberry Pi that you're using as Pi hole to sync, you know, add domains? Do you use like Kali Linux in your spare time? So I definitely recommend take up some side projects to show that passion to get into cyber. And don't be intimidated by the job rec. Sometimes, you know, there's jobs that are open for a while and they might be willing to take someone who's junior and coach them up to get to more of a security kind of role.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. People get really hung up on the job requirements, even if you're not totally qualified. I would definitely apply for it because, yeah, you're right. It's kind of malleable in some cases. And even when candidates don't know stuff, the candidates that don't know stuff, let's say you ask a few different questions about something and they don't know about the topic or have experience on it, what kind of response are you looking for from a candidate when they don't know something?
Yeah, I definitely don't want to hear them make up an answer. That's the worst thing you can do and lie. I would want to hear, I'm not sure about that, but I would search it on Google or whatever, and then be able to come up with an educated response. So I think lying or trying to BS something is the worst thing you can do.
It's so frustrating to listen to too.
Yeah. Yep. I've done interviews with the big like FANG companies and such, and you know, I've gotten grilled and such, and they basically drill you to the point to try to get you to say, I don't know. Like they're just going to keep going. They just want you to be honest and not make something up, and no one knows everything. So I think that's good advice. Just be honest about it. But say, I'll research this. Maybe if you send them a thank you email, you follow up and say, well, I found out that symmetric encryption is way more common than asymmetric encryption or something like that.
Yeah, definitely showing that, hey, I don't know this thing. Like, or let's say it's Terraform or something like that. Like, yeah, I don't have a lot of experience with Terraform. I'd love to be given the opportunity to learn it. I've not had a chance yet in my career. I'll probably mess around with it this weekend or something in my lab or, you know, whatever. But if, as long as you really enthusiasm, it goes so far in an interview. You show that you're passionate about it and you want to learn it. Like I interviewed someone once for a quality assurance position and people were like, were on the fence about him and stuff. And he didn't speak very good English and he didn't have a lot of experience, but he's like, tell me, he's like, man, I dream about defects. And he was just, it was crazy like how passionate he was. And we brought him on and he was a monster. He was so good. So that passion, it goes so far.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, if they're thinking about it outside of work and they're doing things about it, that's a big plus in my book.
So when you want to learn something new, how do you generally tackle that? Like, let's say Kubernetes or something like that. How would you tackle learning that?
I'll start with, if our company has a subscription to something like Pluralsight or LinkedIn Learning or Immersive Labs, I'll figure out what our company has access to. If we don't, I'm personally a visual learner, so I'll usually watch a couple good YouTube videos to be able to understand it. And then CISA, I forget exactly what it stands for. It's something about infrastructure. Basically, it's a government organization that gives advice on like securing critical infrastructure amongst other things, they usually come out with some really good hardening advice. So I'll read through that of how they recommend to secure things. That usually gives me a pretty good idea.
Nice. Are there any particular books you found really valuable for your career?
Yeah, recently I read a book. It's not tech specific, but it's called Measuring Success. It talks about, I think it started around Google, but it talks about objectives and key results. And it really helped as far as like setting goals for yourself. So, you know, in the past for companies, you set your goals at the beginning of the year and you maybe revisit them 6 months later, or you maybe just wait a year and you never talk about it. Where Google and like Brooks actually does this, where we set 3 or 4 goals. Two of them hopefully have to do with like our CTO's goals or our manager's goals to make sure there's alignment. But every single week we talk about where we are with our goals, what roadblocks we might have, and what kind of progress you might make. So you basically break it down into quarters and then report it on it every week. So there's no surprises ever. And you can adjust if necessary because things do change. So that was really helpful because it makes things much more attainable and has less surprises for managers.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting the way different managers handle that and kind of like reporting up. So it's almost like maybe you have like a weekly meeting or even a daily meeting, right? But just, you know, kind of giving status and everything. But if you're in a situation where your manager sets goals like that and you're reporting up the status and stuff, and you find that you're doing a bunch of firefighting or your manager keeps adding scope creep, it is your job to speak up and be like, hey, you said you wanted XYZ. Now you're asking for ABC. I'm not going to be able to do XYZ. Like, which is more important? And that's like stuff that you find that junior engineers, they just start putting in crazy hours. They're not delivering anything. It's just like, no, you got to like hold your manager accountable for like rewriting the plan in the middle of it. Right. And the manager might not realize they're doing it. Right. But you got to point that out.
Yeah. And then it's having tangible numbers associated with it. Like you talked about SSL decryption. That's a big project. Like that might take the full year. So being able to break that up into quarterly, trying to plan out like what might happen the first, second, third quarter of, you know, creating the profile, the certificates, uploading them, making sure that all works. And then maybe by the end of the first quarter, you have a handful of workstations that are tested and that work. Then you move on second, third quarter. And by the end, you have a goal to have everything rolled out and things change. But it's nice to be able to have tangible, you know, the key result is like how it happens. The objective is implements SSL decryption for VPN. But then you can break that down into the 4 key results are making sure their certificate's right, making sure that's deployed everywhere, really working with developers, because that's always the biggest challenge because they go to like GitHub or, you know, they run things through a subsystem for Linux or that stuff. So that was super helpful. Be able to break that down and level set with your manager. And not have that scope creep like you just talked about.
Speaking of development, I mean, not just development, but other departments in general, including development. Do you have tips for working, I guess, with other departments as a security professional?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I've seen a lot of different things at different companies. I think so much about security is relationship building. You really want to get to know what projects are people on, like infrastructure and network engineering or probably two of the people I talk to the most outside of my own team. And you want to have joint goals. So network hardening, if that's like your job and you're trying to make sure configurations for all your network devices are great, they need to be incentivized to do that too. You know, that should be on their goal map. So they have a stake in the game. Because if that's only on yours, what's the incentive for them to get it done? Because they're a good person, you know? So I think having that relationship with like network engineers, infrastructure, maybe people who work with AD or developers is so important. And doing things like proactively and quickly for them. Like there's no better way than if they put in a request for like an SSL decryption bypass, get that done within like 15 minutes. You know, show them that you're dedicated to them. That way when you need their help, they have in the back of their mind, when Steve helped me, he helped me within an hour or something. So that's my biggest advice. Make sure they're incentivized. And then when they ask you for things, like try to do it as quickly and as right as possible.
That's really good advice. I like that. So do you have any favorite interview questions?
Favorite interview questions. When I interviewed for Aetna, They asked me to describe a database to a five-year-old. So I feel like anything, any stuff like that of describing really complex concepts. But from a more behavioral perspective, I usually like to ask, why are they leaving their current job? Because if the reason they're leaving is also something that your company is like, it might not be the best fit. So I find that is usually pretty helpful. And then how they like to be managed if you're a manager. Because once again, if their manager, I've had managers where I haven't really gone along with and didn't work out. If that manager is the same way, it might not work out. So I like to usually ask those behavioral type questions.
Nice. Do you want to leave our listeners with any parting words of wisdom?
Sure. Yeah. I really appreciate being able to talk to you. I think it's been a really fun conversation. As far as it leaving words, I think the cyber community is awesome. Like I think Aman mentioned in one of your previous interviews, there's no other community that is really proactive as far as answering questions, helping each other, trying to pay it forward. So if you're thinking about security or you're already in it, do what you can outside and show your passion to learn. And I couldn't recommend cyber enough. I think it's a fun job and you'll never be done learning.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. Well, thanks for taking the time to be here today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
If you like the episode today and would like to help support us, please hit subscribe, drop us a review, or share it with your friends. Thanks.